Tonight we talk about magic, and that's with a J. Magic Eyes Only, a top-secret security classification for overwhelming proof of the most deeply held secret on the planet. We are not alone in the universe. In a moment, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Ryan S. Wood, will be right back. Ryan Wood earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics and Computer Science from California Polytechnic State University, and he's worked for Intel, Digital Equipment, Toshiba, and two Silicon Valley startups. He has developed and executed advertising and promotion campaigns, direct mail programs, and telemarketing in both consumer businesses and industrial products, and he currently manages the content of www.majesticdocuments.com and has completed the documentary titled The Secret. Ryan has also published two books and a CD-ROM dealing with the Majestic documents and their authenticity. As a UFO investigator with MUFON, he has chosen to specialize in the strategic problems of ufology, such as unquestionable proof, improved media acceptance. He's our guest tonight for the full program on Coast to Coast. Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Oh, great, George. I'm glad to be with you.
Oh, me too. Great work, by the way. Let me just say that right now. At the outset, to put together these 70-plus cases of crashed UFOs and to go into the method that you did to research it, very well done.
Yeah, well, thank you. I enjoyed putting it together, and it was a fun experience, and this is what I personally was looking for all along, but nobody had really done it.
You know, I looked at some of the who's who players who have, one, written the foreword in the book, and then also commented on the work. And just so everyone has an idea, some of the heavy hitters that you deal with on a regular basis, our very favorite Jim Mars wrote the foreword to your work. Linda Moulton Howe, who's our reporter, who will be on tomorrow, writes a little quote for you. Stanton Friedman, I've coined the phrase for him as the father of modern-day ufology.
Uh-huh.
Richard Dolan. So you've got some people who have committed their careers to trying to unravel this UFO story. And it's a tight-knit family, Ryan, isn't it?
It is a tight-knit family, but I knew going in that this book, not only to do it properly, you need to work with the experts in the various crash retrieval incidents, like Roswell and Stan and Stan Gordon and Kexberg and things like that, but to get the community behind it and supporting it and get their input and make sure they all feel good about it and good about the book, because I wanted it to be a high-quality, high-impact vehicle to really advance the cause. Is unquestionable proof, you know, in the form of hardware, in my mind, is the holy grail, and that's what I'm keyed in on.
I think it's very important for you to take a few moments to talk with us about your father, Dr. Robert Wood, because, you know, you basically followed in his footsteps. I think it was his interest, his fascination, that probably helped steer you into the path you've taken. But tell us a little bit about him, Ryan.
Yeah, well, you know, my father first got involved in UFOs in 69 when Stan Friedman when Stan Friedman came to dinner. I mean, it's when I got involved. My father got involved maybe a year earlier when he was asked to figure out what should we do for the retirement of General Schriever, and he has a whole Air Force base named after him now, and quite a number of awards, very big military general. And he whimsically said to his boss, well, why don't we tell him how UFOs work? And his boss said, well, sure, that's a great idea, Bob. Go work that up. And so he read one book and then read 50 books, and then he was doing gravity control and experiments at McDonnell Douglas on their nickel, trying to change the speed of light and do various straight, pure R&D efforts, you know, with no evidence to work from, you know, like crashed hardware or anything like that.
Yeah, so they didn't give him anything to reverse, right?
Exactly. Yeah, he was a theoretical physicist an aeronautical engineer, and he was, and his $500,000 budget and six or seven guys back in 1970. And
what kind of money was that for a budget, even back in the 70s?
Today, it's probably about $5 million.
Well, I guess
$3 million.
For developmental money, still not a lot, I guess, is it?
No, I agree. It's not a lot, but it's enough to do some damage.
Yeah.
And, you know, take, you know, read all the literature, and that's really what Stan was hired for at the time, although he worked only a short time. He was hired to look at the UFO literature and said, well, you know, the UFO is disappearing over the horizon in 2 seconds. That means it's 1,000 Gs and making right-angle turns, and it's got huge magnetic fields. So he's just looking at the basic raw data and trying to determine what are the physics parameters we need to investigate.
Did it take your father a long time to accept the fact that UFOs existed in those days?
No, it didn't. I mean, he read one book, and I think it was something terrible, like the Condon Report, or you know, it was
something. And you mean negative about that?
Negative, right? Yeah. And then he'd read a lot more books, and then some people called him up and asked him to, you know, join their team of sort of negative people, and he said no. The evidence is so overwhelming. You know, after you get through 10 or 20 sighting cases, you say, well, you know, that must be real.
Yeah, something is going on.
That's right. And that's the same sort of philosophy I used in Magic Eyes Only. And, you know, once you look through 74, which are in the book, UFO crash retrieval cases, granted in varying quality and sophistication and credibility ultimately, you can't deny that one or two or seven or ten are real.
What are the timeline dates of these 74 crashes? What's the range here?
We started in 1897 in Aurora, Texas, and we end in 1998.
Okay, so in this time period of about 100 years, in investigation of 74 crashes, maybe there were some others that just didn't go and get investigated. But I guess if we went back to the beginning of mankind, maybe, or even to the year 10,
right,
we could have had many more, right?
Right, and that, I have a bias or an English-speaking bias and a literature bias that I, you know, reviewed the literature. I'm not an expert in Russian or Chinese or Japanese or South America, and I'm sure that those areas are no different than the United States in some ways, and they had crashes too that are still in the literature, but I haven't been able to grab hold of them because I don't speak the languages and haven't researched those countries.
Well, now, so here we are. In a 100-year period, we average about a UFO crashing once every year and a quarter, let's say.
Yeah, that's average.
You get one that crashes. What was wrong? I mean, they have this incredible technology to get here from wherever they might have been coming from, yet they crash. 74 crashes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's one of the first things most people ask is, you know, these people are so smart, they travel across the galaxy from the future, or how can they screw up so badly to crash on podunk planet Earth?
I mean, it sounds like traffic in Los Angeles, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Yet there wasn't. What do you think went wrong here?
Well, there's a couple things. You know, there's two things. One is the data is the data, and they seem to be crashing. But set that aside and then speculate as to why they're crashing. Well, we've all heard of military drones used in warfare,
right,
and reconnaissance. Well, who's to say that some of these aren't in the same league of disposable reconnaissance vehicles that are simply, you know, once they've finished their one-way mission across the galaxy, that it's, you know...
Disposable.
That's one thought to think about. The other thought is that it's potentially deliberate, that they're crashing to provide mankind with a past, a future, something to sink their teeth in to work on.
Give us a little technology to play with?
Give us a little technology. You know, it's not going to be easy, and I think that it hasn't been easy for the reverse engineers and the scientists that have worked on this problem, and that, you know, giving Benjamin Franklin a calculator is a pretty nasty problem for Benjamin Franklin.
I've always thought, Ryan, that the bodies that they found at Roswell or the others that you're going to talk with us about, that they may have been robots, for example.
That's another excellent theory. You know, these are disposable biological cyborgs that are just doing their job, and once they're done, or it's an economic thing too, potentially, is they get a little pinhole in their craft via micrometeorite, and they decompress, and that's it. It's over, and it's not worth making the thickness of the metal more robust to make them survive. It's an economic trade-off, you know.
Let's talk about some of your sources for the book.
Uh-huh.
And I think when we get into these cases in a moment, the people are going to be astonished by some of the things. You particularly, and we'll talk about that, but you particularly are an expert in the Cape Girardeau, Missouri crash. And that's of interest to me because my son went to college there.
Uh-huh.
And I've got to tell you, Ryan, every time I went there to see him, and I was from St. Louis, live in L.A. now, go back and forth. Every time I went to Cape Girardeau, I would look around for where I thought that thing might have crashed.
Uh-huh.
You know what? I should have talked to you first. I think you could have steered me in the right direction. We'll get into that in a minute. But tell me a little bit of these 74 cases. What are your major sources for these crashes?
Well, most of the sources are newspaper articles or witness reports. Or existing investigations by experts in various crash retrievals that pull on multiple sources and documents, some of these leaked Majestic documents. But the leaked Majestic documents support only a handful of the crashes that are reported in the book. Now, some of the totally unimpeachable sources are like the National Archives. And declassified moon dust documents that describe, let's say, in Bolivia in 78, we had a huge ovoid, well, huge, 4 meters long, a couple meters wide, silver, landed. The military swept in, picked it up, and took it back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. But not only does the document say that, the witnesses that we interviewed that were on the ground, the military guys,
yeah,
that were part of Moondust, said, oh, yeah, every 6 months or so, most of the time we picked up space junk. But every 6 months we'd pick up something extraterrestrial, and it would go back to Wright-Patterson, to a giant black hole.
And they weren't kidding, were they?
No, they weren't kidding. They were very candid, matter of fact. They knew it was extraterrestrial because, you know, no seams or rivets. You know, four guys can lift the thing up, and it's huge, and they put it on a flatbed. And
could you imagine, Ryan, what they would be telling their family members and friends, being witnesses? I mean, firsthand witnesses to some of these crashes, picking up the debris or a complete saucer, for example. The things that they would tell their wives and friends must have been unbelievable.
I would hope so. I'm sure that some were very upstanding and didn't say anything. And then some, I think, only told us, the investigators, sort of 30, 40 years after the fact, after we showed them documents and they got a sense that a moon dust was declassified. There are lots of wives and children that have stories.
My mother's late sister was married to a fellow who would be gone at weeks at a time, and he would fly, and he would never tell anyone, including his family, where he went and what he did, except that they just knew that he worked at an Air Force base. So he'd go away for weeks, and then he'd come back. And, you know, we began to piece little things together that he would say, but he wouldn't say too much. You know, he'd be in a plane for most of that time. They'd land somewhere and go back up. We began to theorize that he was in a spy plane over the Soviet Union, something like that at the time. And we're talking about 60s, late 60s. But nobody ever knew, Ryan, what he did. So it's very possible that these people who have had these incredible stories, these witnesses, would come home to their families and really never tell them anything.
That's right. I'd say that's probably the majority of the cases.
Man.
And now there are things you can do with this particular case. For example, we have his name. We can look up his military service number. We can get his records from the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis. And you can see, oh, yeah, he's assigned to a strategic bomber wing.
Sure.
So some general thing, and then you can prove that, yeah, he really worked from date X to date Y and what his function in life was, and then you can begin to dig deeper into those records and organizations. But ultimately, it would be difficult, but not impossible with unfettered access to find exactly what he really did.
As you are putting together the sources and the research, was there any single thing, Ryan, that kept popping up that was a similarity in most of these crashes? Anything like that? Any common denominator?
Well, not for all the cases, but the basic theme of it crashes, they create a cover story, they come in, sweep it up, cart it away, and try to leave as little trace as possible and plant cover stories. That is the fingerprint of a crash retrieval operation. And I'm actually working on another crash retrieval in the late 40s that I found because of the fingerprint of cover-up. I could see this stupid, in my mind, Roswell-like cover-up on the front page of the newspaper. And I said, what are they doing? Why did they do that? They didn't do this any other time of the year. And then you trace back a week or two, and there's another little newspaper article that is far more intriguing and implies a crash retrieval.
Well, the ones you investigated for the book, the 74,
right,
were they obvious crashes? Or did you really have to dig for them? Did you need help to find some info?
Well, I used researchers as well as contacted people that were the primary investigator for the crash. But most of it was there in plain sight in Leonard Stringfield's outstanding early work on crash retrievals.
He was one of the best in his day, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was one of the best. Better than I am, or if I could just be as good as he was.
Was he out of Cincinnati?
Yeah, he was out of Cincinnati.
I remember that. Okay.
And he cultivated a score of military friends and associates and was feeding intelligence into the military and getting something back. And I think that the world is a far more complicated place now, that won't happen.
I think he used to work for one of the tire companies at the time.
Yeah.
Firestone, maybe, somebody, one of the offices. I remember talking to him during my television days. And he was just a wonderful individual, so excited about his work. Well, when we come back, let's talk about these specific cases. Find out how you ranked them and rated them, and we'll also talk about some of the players behind these crashes and then what happened to them. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest tonight, Ryan Wood, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Ryan Wood, our guest, his book, Magic Eyes Only. How did you rank all these 74 crashes, Ryan, and how did you rate them?
Well, that's a great question, and with so many cases, you had to decide which ones are really good and which ones are poor. And so I used a series of factors and then ultimately creating a rating. But the factors that I used were the witnesses, are they firsthand witnesses, how professional they are and so forth, and sources, where the data came from and so forth. Zingers, obscure facts, rare, verifiable subtleties, the content of the story, the chronology? Does it all fit and flow in time? Is there anything out of place? Anachronisms or problems with the case, you know, that say, oh, it's a fake because blank. And then the forensics, if they're available. Some cases we have physical hardware to test. We've got parts, pieces of metal from the saucers. In Aurora, Texas, for example, we have pieces of the saucer. In Ramey Baca's case in 1945 in San Antonio, New Mexico, we have parts. Those are the sort of key factors, and they have different multiplying factors. I rated forensics much stronger than sort of the content of the story.
Let's go back, because I want you to pull out the five top cases the way you've ranked them, okay? And okay. I want to talk about those. But let's go back to 1942 at the time. Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall. What's going on then?
Well, in 1942, we had the Los Angeles air raid occurred, and one of the leaked Majestic documents that Marshall wrote says, hey, we had one go down in the ocean that the Navy recovered and one in the San Bernardino Mountains that the Army recovered or Army Air Forces recovered. And that sort of kicked things off, and he decided, well, I want you to review all the data we have all the way back to 1897. Some reason he chose that particular date corresponds with the Aurora, Texas crash, and put together a program, which ultimately became the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, part of the Counterintelligence Directorate Technical and Scientific Branch, which later served to the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence.
How do we know this IPU unit existed?
Well, we have a couple of FOIA cases where Freedom of Information Act requests have been made to the Air Force, and the Air Force acknowledged that the unit existed and described where it existed. So we have official confirmation that the unit existed. They didn't explain anything more than the title of Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. And then we have leaked documents that are supportive of something far more sinister, so to speak, in the world of crash retrievals.
Oh, really? UFOs. Okay. Such as?
Well, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, there are there's the Marshall Memo in 42, which is stamped on the top, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, sort of after the fact or maybe a month after or so. And then we have a long and detailed seven-page report that describes the results of the counterintelligence team investigation at Roswell.
Well, this IPU unit, what kind of people were in there, Ryan? I mean, were they scientists and military people like that?
I think that primarily, it was more of an operative organization, so be mostly military. However, they had the capacity to draw on other experts, and in some cases, they brought other experts to the Roswell events. They brought a medical doctor, and they brought in other experts in the field. But I think it was primarily a military organization that, you know, was focused on
covert,
grabbing the bodies, grabbing the hardware, making a good cover story, and getting it back to headquarters.
So it was covert?
It was absolutely, totally covert.
Was it like a Project Blue Book group, or it was probably even darker?
Oh, much, much darker, yeah. I mean, the history of official projects from Project Sign to Project Grudge to Project Blue Book all sort of flavors of white cover stories or lights in the sky investigations and very skeptical ones at that, which is the core of the Blue Book today, or the evidence that's in the Blue Book files today. I mean, I interviewed a secretary who worked at Blue Book, who's alive today, lives in Las Vegas, and she said, oh, yeah, I mean, we all knew that crash retrievals were classified higher than what we were doing.
Really?
Yeah. And
that's incredible stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we routinely didn't deal with that, and we were the white cover story. It was also common knowledge that everything classified secret was penetrated by the KGB back in history. And so Blue Book was all just secret level classification, nothing top secret.
Now, these 74 crashes in the book,
yeah,
were they just in the United States, or were they all around the planet?
All around the planet.
Ah, okay. Okay.
So, yeah, all around the planet. Although there is a, you know, quite a number in the United States, and that may be due to just the fact that I have good data in the United States, and there's been more investigations that I'm aware of, and the literature, the UFO literature, is aware of.
I was asked tonight, and I'm glad you're on the program, if UFOs are continuing to crash with all this technology that we have. They even mentioned camera phones on cell phones. Why we aren't getting more information, more pictures, what's going on? So first question then, Brian, is are they still crashing?
Well, that's a good question. And I don't know. We don't have any recent evidence. I'm sure they keep getting better and better at managing the problem and maintaining security. They started with the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb and have gotten better and better and better. So there's that working against with. On the other side, you know, the civilians have more cameras and video, and we see that in Mexico. We see lots more video of lights in the sky and so forth. I guess my personal opinion is that they're crashing less. But
they can't be any more technologically better.
Yeah, they may be crashing at the same density. But, you know, the reason for crashing, one of the reasons, may have been, you know, the explosion of the atomic bomb and radar and guided missiles. And they know from an evolutionary point of view that this planet is changing its path and history. And now is the time to show them the future.
All right, let's talk about some of these crashes. Let's talk about five of them, the top five. Start with number five. We're going to build our way up to number one as we continue this discussion with you, Ryan. But of the five crashes of the 74, the one that was ranked number five, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, what I did in the ranking and rating is I used, a percentile, 0 to 20, 20 to 40, and so forth,
sure.
80 to 100. And what you're really talking about is the 80 to 100 range crashes that are discussed. The first one that I'm, and this is not necessarily within the top five, some are even better than others.
Okay, but, I understand.
Aurora, Texas is the first one in 1897 that's in my top five. And the reason there is primarily the work of Jim Mars and the work of John Schussler. Jim Mars in investigating it, although others have investigated.
Sure.
But the stories, the materials, the cysts, and the biological impact of the witnesses that were involved, and then at the same time, the work that John Schussler did in 1970 analyzing the various materials that came from the crash, showing that they're ultra pure and they were beyond the scope and skill of modern science of the 70s.
All right, let's talk about Aurora, Texas. It's 1897. What's it look like at the time out there?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a quick synopsis. On April 17th, 1897, dawned a clear and cool day in North Texas when out of the south came a large silver cigar-shaped object. It dropped lower and lower and approached the small hamlet of Aurora, Texas, less than 20 miles northwest of Fort Worth, where it struck a windmill and exploded, scattering debris and at least one small body in all directions. Despite a straight-faced coverage in local newspapers at the time, the Aurora crash continues to be a source of controversy, and every few years the story is brought up by various newspaper and periodicals. Some debunkers argue that the Aurora spaceship crash story was a hoax, a fake story planted in the newspapers to draw attention to the little town that was being bypassed by the railroad. And that is the extent of the most damning allegation against this case.
They had conspiracies in those days, too, didn't they?
That's right. You know, the fact that...
They need the railroad to go through the city, so let's concoct a UFO crash.
That's right. You know, they could have come up with something a little more ingenious.
Now, how in the heck could a UFO hit a windmill?
Well, you know, I don't know.
And knock it down, for crying out loud.
Yeah, these are good questions. You know, there's... Another thought as far as why they crash is the natural weather, the lightning storm. It's not that a lightning storm was here. There is the allegation in the Roswell cases in 47 that weather played a factor.
How do we know it wasn't a dirigible?
Well, the materials that came from the crash material that was found there on the site and analyzed, says that it's clearly not a dirigible.
I mean, if it hit a windmill, it couldn't have been up too high, 50 feet maybe in those days?
Right, yeah, maybe 80 feet or something.
So what did it do, explode when it hit?
Yeah, I think that it's not clear whether or not...
Because if it fell from 50 feet, the whole thing should have been intact.
Yeah, we're assuming that the windmill damaged it rather than it exploded on its own.
Right.
It have to be in the presence of a windmill. And I think that's probably the more likely case. But I agree. You know, if it falls from 50 feet, it should just be intact. But the witness testimony and data says that it exploded, and the parts that were picked up seem to be radioactive, and this is 1897 and caused some biological harm to Brawley Oates, who got a lot of disfiguring cysts from drinking the water and possibly handling the wreckage. And he moved it around several times. And the alien that was found was given a proper burial.
In that town, right?
In that town with a grave marker that's no longer there today, but there was pictures taken of it in the 70s, and there's even a historical marker from the state of Texas that describes this event.
Weren't the remains tampered with of this ET?
Well, the stories are mixed. You know, the sheriff guarded the remains for some time, and the headstone, but eventually after a few days went home. And then it seemed like the metal piece that was around the ET's neck or the remains were removed.
What's the description of what the body was prior to burial?
Small, typical sort of gray.
Typical alien, like Roswell.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say that's...
Big head, big eyes, that...
Yeah, that sort of ilk, yeah.
All right. And they buried the creature.
They buried the creature and gave it a proper burial, as the newspaper said.
If you went to Aurora, Texas today, do they talk about this? Do they show you where the site might have been?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't really know. And it's one of the things that I wanted to talk to Jim Mars about and potentially motivate him or urge him to go back to the site today and try to find the precise location and try to find more parts, more metal parts, because I think more physical evidence is a powerful thing. You know?
Did they ever run the railroad through Aurora, Texas?
No, they did not. But, you know, I think it bypassed it by 8 miles. I mean,
can you imagine, though, the hoopla and the report that the story might have...
Yeah. Well, in 1897, railroads are everything. It's like getting an airport or a mass transit. Or it's profits and dollars and people and future and fortune.
All right. We're going to talk about one of the other four when we come back. Now, the work you did, of course, putting together these 74 crashes.
Yeah.
Did you come across any potential problems where someone said, basically, stay out of this? Any of that happen, Ryan?
No, nobody said stay out of it, but there's a few cases that I called myself after reading and said, you know, this is just a meteor in somebody's lawn, and decided to not put it in because it was just too prosaic an explanation. It was too obvious. I would be a little embarrassed writing it down. And more crashes and hoaxes are sort of coming out of the woodwork that I've been made aware of. And I'm probably going to, in the next edition, create a little two-page addendum in the back that said, you know, these are the ones that I didn't include, and why, and so forth, so people get a complete picture.
Of the five we're talking about tonight, maybe more, is Cape Girardeau in one of those?
I think I have to look here to see the authenticity meter. I think Cape Girardeau is a four and not a five.
Okay.
We'll look.
All right. While we get into the break here, you can look at that as well.
Okay.
Any specific areas of this planet have more crashes than the others?
Well, New Mexico seems to be a real hotbed. I think that...
Even in the old days?
Especially in the old days. In 47, we had 10 crashes that are reviewed in the book, and I think that... seven of them are in New Mexico. I need to.
Yeah, no,
I'll go scan down the table of contents and try to summarize some of these location concentrations.
All right, the book Magic Eyes Only, is it out now?
Yes, it's out. It's available on my website at magiceyesonly.com, or you can get it on Amazon. So it's freely available, and it's been very popular. And
I better spell magic again. It's M-A-J-I-C.
Yeah, that's right. And you can go to the Coast to Coast website and link on my name and go right to the website.
Okay, well, when we come back, let's talk about the four of these other top cases. Tell us a little bit more about Leonard Stringfield and some of his work. And there's some other people out there as well, other names, interesting names that come into this. And then how does SETI fit into your book? That's interesting. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment, Ryan S. Wood, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. Yep, that's from the old television show Fireball XL5. My engineer does not remember it, has no idea why we're playing that tonight. It's a classic. I get emails on that every time we play. When we come right back, we'll continue this discussion with Ryan Wood. We'll get into some more of these crashes, these incredible UFO cases on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Ryan Wood, my guest, and we talk about these UFO crashes and retrieval. Eventually, Ryan, we've got to get into what the military does with these craft once they pick them up. But let's go to our second one of your favorite crash retrievals.
Yeah, stories. I mean, Roswell is the second on the list. The five, just quickly, are Aurora, Texas, Roswell, Braxton County, Kecksburg, and Shag Harbor. Those are the top five that
okay.
have the highest list. But the second one is Roswell, which is, the penultimate crash retrieval scenario. It's been investigated by a countless number of investigators, and the evidence is fairly strong from hundreds of, maybe not hundreds, but scores of witnesses and some of the leaked Majestic documents, to the testimony of Jesse Marcel and so forth. It's a very nice case, but there's still room for further investigation, finding the exact sites or gaining access or finding more witnesses. But it's been thoroughly vetted, and this is why it gets its high rating, is that it's been out there for 20-plus years, all sorts of researchers have looked at it, they've thought about it, and they all sort of agree on the core elements, that something crashed, there's lots of witnesses to it, and it was taken away by the military. And the details change from book to book, or whether or not you're interviewing Stan Friedman or Kevin Randall mm-hmm. or others. But it's a real strong case. And
you know, Ryan, what's so strong about it is the fact that the military changed their story. I think when that happened, you know, when it was announced first that they had picked up a crashed saucer, and then they changed the story the next day. I mean, that's amazing.
Right. And then there's also some physical evidence when, you know, Art Bell got mailed pieces allegedly from the Roswell wreckage. Art's parts, right. And Linda Howe has them, this unique bismuth magnesium layered material that's virtually impossible to do with modern science and has some unusual properties. Now, you can't trace the provenance right to Roswell, but I don't see why people would be lying. So, I mean, there you have good physical evidence, good internal consistency, lots of time, lots of research, and lots of witnesses. And when you add up all those in the rating factors, you can see why it gets a really high score.
What about the story from the funeral director about, you know, the military coming in wanting three small coffins?
You know, all these elements are just wonderful evidence that something really crashed and there were really alien bodies and on. And just last week, I was down at Fort Peterson in Colorado Springs and went out to lunch with a medical doctor and another guy from the base there. And the medical doctor said to me, "Ryan, I want you to know that Roswell's real. And here's why. I was with some military guys. They flew over the area. They landed. And they said, this is where it happened." And the guy had tears in his eyes and was clearly emotional. You know, it's a second or third hand witness to this event, but you don't get that emotion unless something is real.
I would have loved to have been there in 1947.
I think we all would have.
Of any spot, all these that we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you mentioned how many were in New Mexico, and I added them up, and there seems to be 7 out of the 74 that are in New Mexico. And there was 10 crashes that are reported in the Magic Eyes Only book during the year of 1947.
Maybe it's no mistake that Richard C. Hoagland lives in New Mexico as well. You know?
Maybe.
Okay, that's Roswell.
Yeah, that's Roswell.
And then
the next one is Braxton County, West Virginia, in 1952, September of 52. And have you had Frank Fascino on your program?
Yes, yes, I sure have. As a matter of fact, he came on with Stanton Friedman.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a bizarre episode, Ryan, as you well know. And then the being or the creature or the object is strange. But if I remember, wasn't the saucer and the creature one of the same? Wasn't it like a creature that just, you know, like took off like a flying saucer would?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I remember this, you know, large robot type creature. But what impressed me about this particular case was the fact that you had several live living witnesses that you could interview that talked or that described the same thing, and you had police officers involved. You had military investigators going out. You also had this huge air battle with jets and fighters chasing UFOs that was very well documented in Frank's work. And all that gives it a high rating in my mind, that you have high-quality witnesses.
Witnesses who don't have anything to gain, right?
Right, yeah. Well, what's a 7-year-old going to gain? Or a 9-year-old? You know, it's probably a giant negative to say anything about it. And then there's some potential subtle linkages. One of the pilots that got killed in this apparent dogfight with the UFO was interesting. And then his commander, which was Benjamin Chidlaw, part of the Air Defense Command, which was headquartered at Int Air Force Base in New Mexico. Just an aside, Int Air Force Base was where Harry Bob Cooper, who is the father of Tim Cooper, got his commendation for outstanding work in the U.S. Air Force UFO program. And this, I think, is very interesting in that a lot of the work went on at Int Air Force Base back in the 50s, dealing with UFOs, and reproduced in the sort of color section of the book is his commendation, as well as other pictures of alleged wreckage and so forth.
Ryan, did anybody ever report anything dangerous with these crash retrievals?
Oh, yes. I mean, in the Roswell event, some of the Majestic documents, actually the first annual report, talks about some of the Sandia engineering district technicians that were called out from Sandia Base to pick up the ET bodies in the best full protective suit of the day in 1947, which amounted to a couple of double fatigues and some long rubber gloves and a crude gas mask. Picked up the bodies, put them in body bags, and died of profuse bleeding from the nose and mouth within hours.
Huh.
And that's an example of some of the people that have died for the sake of...
Severe radioactivity?
No, I think it's biologic activity.
Some kind of virus or something?
Yeah, virus, something maybe like Ebola, some foreign biologic toxin. And that's not the only case where this foreign biologic toxin comes in contact with ETs. The Chihuahua case of 74 that's in Mexico, where the Federales picked up the ET bodies and all died as well. That was the subject of a History Channel special.
That's like the Mexican Roswell case, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That was what it was billed as, the Mexican Roswell. But the secret, or not the secret, but the difference, is that the U.S. went in and grabbed their saucer and took it away, and that the Mexicans didn't get their own material.
Who got it?
Some sort of U.S. special operations team came in and took it from the dead Mexicans. And now this case is not rated a 5. It's rated, I think, sort of neutral. You have one good leaked document, and you have one additional witness that was just dug up by the History Channel about 3 months ago when they went down to film the program.
They've been doing a good job on some of these cases, the History
Channel.
Yeah, that's
right. Their last program on Mexico was very good and very level-headed and didn't have any stupid stuff on it. So I was very impressed with that. But, you know, again, that's sort of a neutral case, and it's just begging for more investigation. And, you know, 60% of all the cases that are in the book are in that category, the sort of neutral. There's a kernel, a seed of something fascinating and engaging and interesting and very likely to be a crash retrieval. But to take it to the next level, you got to do research and investigate. And they don't have investigators. You know, where there was a lead investigator, I talked to Stan Gordon about Kexburg or Frank Fascino. and Stan about Roswell, and Jim Mars about Aurora and so forth, and a few of the other cases that Nick Redfern has done several cases. And you have to go to sort of those people that have written books or articles, periodicals. The whole thing is very well referenced, too, with a good index.
Well, the Kexburg case had some great eyewitness testimony to it.
Oh, that's right. And I'm even working on a little subtlety of the Kexburg case myself, in that the reporter that went down into the field and took pictures, and then the military sort of confronted him and asked for his camera and so forth. He mysteriously died a couple of years later in California, and I'm investigating his murder because...
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of murders, I mean, related to this topic. You know, how can a guy pass four lanes of freeway and on the 101 in 1969 or something like that, with two of his buddies, and get hit by a Volkswagen bus going 55 miles an hour on a clear night, full moon, without being drunk. You know, that's right.
And the other driver was not either, right?
No, the other driver wasn't drunk at all, and the other driver's still alive. And I'm trying to hunt him down. And,
do we know who he worked for?
It's far more likely that his friends that were with him, two characters from West Virginia that threw him in front of the bus or had killed him already and dragged him out and threw him in front of the bus.
All because of, you think?
All because he had evidence and wouldn't give it up. I think that he actually had pictures. He'd faked out the military and palmed the real photos. He was there. He was a first-hand witness with some credibility in danger.
Let's talk about Shag Harbor, one of the best cases.
Yeah, Shag Harbor. Have you done that program or done that?
I've not done a whole show on Shag Harbor, and it's been a long time since I've done anything about it, Ryan. So why don't you take us back to? Why don't you just tell us the whole case on this one?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find it here in the book to refresh my memory. But this is up in Nova Scotia, I believe, and in Canada. And a UFO comes down, creates a sort of a fog over the lake area, and then goes underneath the lake. And several witnesses see this, and they come out and look at it. And more local police get involved, and then the craft moves some distance away, and more Navy people come in, and divers come in, and they come down and touch the craft, and there's, I think, a couple of crafts down there.
Underwater, with lights.
Underwater.
Right? Yeah.
And you got Navy divers going down and confirming that it's all there, and documents and witnesses, and some of the Navy divers have been interviewed. It's a very, and then they disappear. You know, it's not a classic crash retrieval, but it seems to be something underwater.
And it stayed underwater for a long time, didn't it?
It was like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, in the same spot?
Yeah, in the same spot with the same divers.
And when it finally left, did it leave in the ocean and then just went away that way, or did it smash its way out of the water and then take off?
My understanding is it sort of disappeared underwater and that it didn't break the surface and go back.
How would you like to be one of the divers and you're swimming around the craft and maybe it had windows or portals and you're looking in and a face of an alien looks back at you?
That would be...
I'd freak.
Yeah, I would freak, too. You know, some of those divers are used to, you know, digging up dead bodies. That's got to be a pretty freaky experience as well. There's, you know, lots of witnesses here, and it's very official, lots of documents. And Don Ledger has done loads of research on this, as well as some of his other compatriots.
What when you came away with knowledge of all these crashes, what is the main focus of what you felt, that governments had them and had tremendous technology because of it, that these craft were crashing because of strange reasons? I mean, what one singular issue kept coming up in your mind?
I'd say that it doesn't seem to be a single issue. It seems to be the totality of not only the crashes, but what I've heard. The cover-up is real. The evidence is real. This is the most important secret on the planet. And the fact that we're not alone, we're working very feverishly to leverage these celestial gifts and take an economic and military and national security advantage of it. And I'm sure that not only the United States is doing that, but the USSR and any other country where the official military has recovered it.
Did you come across the story when Richard Nixon was the president, his buddy Jackie Gleason, the comedian, kept edging him on about UFOs and aliens, and finally Nixon said, come with me. And this is the story I hear,
right? Right, that's right.
He gets in the car, Gleason gets in the car with Richard Nixon, who's the president. Nixon drives the car. There's no Secret Service, there's nothing. The two of them drive into Homestead Air Force Base. The guard looks in and goes, oh, my God. In they go, and apparently Nixon brought Jackie Gleason in to see an alien body.
That's right, and that's been confirmed not only by a couple of different people, but...
let's talk about that. Do you know a lot about that case?
No, I don't, and Grant Cameron, who's sort of the expert on the presidents and UFOs.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But that's an incredible story, because apparently Gleason was never the same after that, according to his wife at the time. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Ryan Wood. We'll open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chat about these UFOs as well. Ryan, great pictures in the book, by the way, the black and white ones, even the color ones.
Oh, yeah, that was fun. These are some of the leaked photos that came with the Tim Cooper trove, or actually ultimately from Thomas Cantwheel, the purloiner of many of these majestic, modern majestic documents. Some of them are, you know, taken off a TV screen and are a little fuzzy and grainy, but they clearly show some wreckage scenes that look like the New Mexico desert of craft that are extremely large, a cross section of being like 12 feet, and then smaller ones where the craft looks to be about 30 feet long. And then pictures of Truman and pictures of the MJ-12 Scientific Advisory Board for the Air Force.
There's a great picture of an image that was emailed apparently to Art Bell.
That's right.
Right, a picture of an alien in some kind of chamber.
Right, all plastic chamber. And in the bottom corner, in the very fine print, there's a little temperature gauge, and it says Majestic in the corner. You don't know whether or not it's real, but it sure looks real.
When was that done? A long time ago?
I think maybe 3-4 years ago.
Well, it's an eerie picture.
Yeah, it's a very eerie picture. The uniform seems to be not, modern American military. I think it seems to be more South American.
Ryan, did you ever investigate, or what have you heard about that case with Neil Armstrong when he was on the moon and apparently he radioed back and talked about the huge craft that were, they were looking at him, they were on the other side of a crater? Is that real, what we keep hearing, or is it made up? What do you hear in your circles?
I guess I don't have any data one way or the other. and I haven't really investigated it. I learned long ago in this field that I really wanted to specialize in documents and paper trail and crash retrievals, and that's really why I do a crash retrieval conference every year and just focus on crash retrievals. It's fascinating that particular story that you brought up, you know, hey, you got a credible witness talking about something pretty fantastic.
I'd love to hear the tape if it exists.
Right. Well, finding the tape, back then I think they did not have secure communications between, or maybe they did, I'm not sure.
They might have. Yeah, I think they had a secure channel.
You should be able to FOIA the secure channel and have somebody transcribe it, yeah, redact it, and have the witness. Well, the witness, you said Neil Armstrong, right?
Yeah. But now the episode with Jackie Gleason.
Right.
He's taken to Homestead Air Force Base by Richard Nixon, then president, goes in and sees an alien encased. And just freaks out, apparently. And according to his wife at the time, he was never the same. Never the same. He used to joke. He was jovial. He changed, she said.
Right. And I think even, I want to say Peter Robbins one time interviewed Gleason's wife. And Gleason's wife recounted the same story and showed many of the UFO books that Gleason was
into. He was into all that.
Yeah. And I think Gleason's library of UFO books was bequeathed to a local library.
Really? God, I wish you were alive now. I'd love to have him on the program.
Yeah.
Would be something.
It would be something. And, you know, I also took the opportunity in the book to sort of thoroughly put forth the best positive effort concerning the Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities, Technology, Recovery, and Disposal.
Who put that together, the manual?
Well, it was my father has done a lot of the work on the Special Operations Manual, and I've helped him in a few cases working on various subtleties.
This is a military manual?
This is a military manual dated April 1954. And it's the title. It's in the appendix in the back and discussed in the sort of the introduction. But this manual says it all. If the manual's real, it's a how-to manual on how to capture them and
what to do with them afterwards.
What to do with them afterwards, and how to cover it up from.
And when you say cover up, you're not. Are you talking about, like, shrouding it, or are you talking about the cover-up?
No, like covering up the physical event.
Ah, okay.
You know, you have a crash in the area. What do you do now? What do you tell the press? How do you manage the local tactical situation? And there's, you know, the manual's been out since 1994 when it was mailed to Don Berliner from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
By the way, in West Virginia, apparently another coal miner problem. They're searching for two miners missing after a fire started on a conveyor belt in one of the mines 60 miles southwest of Charleston. So another episode. So sad. Go ahead.
Yeah. But this Special Operations Manual, some of the things that most people don't know that we've done, besides thoroughly retyping it and checking all the style manual.
Is that in your book?
It's in the book, page 268 through the end.
I just opened it up to 268. How bizarre is that?
Well, that's...
There it is.
There it is. And this manual, we traced it back to the Quillen Pharmacy in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and to the owners of the Quillen Pharmacy and one of our assets held the original in his hand, and we've been trying to get a copy of it, or an original page for forensic testing. But
this is what it says right on the cover. It says, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology, Recovery and Disposal.
That's right.
Top Secret Magic Eyes Only. Warning. This is a Top Secret Magic Eyes Only document containing compartmentalized information essential to the national security of the United States. Eyes Only access to the material herein is strictly limited to personnel possessing Magic-12 clearance level. Examination or use by unauthorized personnel is strictly forbidden and is punishable by federal law. And I bet they weren't fooling around, were they?
No, certainly not in 1954. But there's I've given hour-long lectures on the details of this manual, and suffice to say that of all the Majestic documents that I've looked at, including the Eisenhower briefing document, this is the one that my father and I are at the top of the list. We're in the 99% confidence that it's real, for a whole bunch of reasons, and some zingers in the way the typography is done, from the content, from the fact that screwdriver is two words instead of one word, or first aid is capitalized. If you just like read that manual, log into my website or read this, and you say this manual's real, then everything sort of falls
into
place.
Sure. Well, here's one here. I love this. Extraterrestrial biological entities, they call them EBEs,
right,
must be removed to a top security facility as quickly as possible. Great care should be taken to prevent possible contamination by alien biological agents. Dead EBEs should be packed in ice at the earliest opportunity to preserve tissues. Should live EBEs be encountered, they should be taken into custody and removed to a top secret facility by ambulance. Every effort should be taken to ensure the EBE's survival. Personnel involved with EBEs, alive or dead, must be kept to an absolute minimum. I love that.
Yeah, it's a well-written manual that follows the style rules for how it was written for 1954, because we interviewed a retired U.S. Government printing office executive that actually wrote the style manual, and we showed him this, and he looked it over and said, "Yeah, boy, this is real for the following reasons." And
how thick is this?
This is a 32-page manual, but we only have 23 or 4 pages. There's another interesting little subtlety for why it's real, is that in section 6, you know, the guide to UFO identification,
mm-hmm,
was missing. However, Brian Parks, a UFO researcher, had FOIA'd the Air Force and gotten a UFO-B identification guide in double-space typing courier font, you know, like 7 or 8 pages. And when you retyped it in this format, it perfectly dovetailed and all the paragraph markings and page numbers lined up. So that's just another little quirk that lends itself to authenticity.
Let's go to some calls. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, Mr. Norrie?
Yes, sir. Hi.
This is Paul from Chicago. Excuse me.
Sure.
A couple of years ago, an incident happened here on April the 17th at 11:30 p.m. on a Saturday. It was supposed to have been subsequently a meteor falling, but the way it happened, it was kind of weird. First, without warning, the sky just lit up like it was broad daylight and flickered like a strobe, kind of yellowish-blue color, and mostly yellow. Very, very bright, just like it was daylight. And this was through a thick cloud cover. And then it just went black. And immediately afterwards, there was a bolt of fire out from the clouds, and followed by some sparks of the same color. A chunk supposedly landed, it crashed to a house in Park Forest in my hometown. But the thing about it was, at the time when this happened, there was no sound at all. There was no pressure sensation. And even though some fragments were collected, everybody shut up about it immediately afterwards. There was no, you'd expect there would be something in some scientific periodicals.
Sure, something somewhere.
Yeah, but nothing. They just shut up about it like, boom.
Was there any newspaper articles or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. There may have been, but not that I know.
Yeah. Well, you know,
the whole thing just hushed up like never happened.
How common is that, Ryan?
That's a good question, Nero. How common is that? And I don't really know, because most of the time the focus is on crashes that keep, you know, you have more evidence than that. But I think that people's denial of this and, I really don't want to look at that and feel uncomfortable about it is pretty high, especially when it's in your face.
What got Leonard Stringfield interested in trying to chase down crash retrievals?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I'm not really sure. I think he was fascinated with this topic. I think he felt it was very important to focus on hard evidence, and he had, risen to the top of his sort of civilian research organization.
He wrote a lot of, like, pamphlets about them, right?
Right, yeah. He wrote these status reports on crash retrievals, and I've got them all, and they're sort of raw data. He didn't do a lot of analysis of various reports.
He just laid it out there the way it was.
Right. He would have taken this report and written it up and said, here's the data, and let other people sort of dig in and try to research. But I've reviewed all his material and taken all the cases that I felt were significant crash retrievals and incorporated in the book.
Now, SETI is incorporated in the book somehow. Tell me why.
Yeah, well,
Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Yeah, I think the common man in the street says, well, you know, I can't believe that stuff crashes all the time. Why do we keep looking for signals from space? Why does the SETI program exist? Why do they pour hundreds of millions of dollars into the SETI program if they already have this? And it's a reasonable question. So I wanted to sort of clearly swat that down and say how unintelligent and naive the SETI program was and dig a little deeper, not only from the technology point of trying to listen with radio waves, a technology that's pretty old, to advanced civilizations traveling around in the universe, to the fact that Lloyd Berkner, one of the original MJ-12 people, convinced Frank Drake to set up Project OSMA and begin the whole SETI process. So you can see right from the get-go that the fingers of MJ-12 could have been directly there to create a cover story.
Did you ever come across a case in Brazil where a police officer, I think, did he die or something?
The Varginha case?
Yes.
Yes, Varginha. Varginha is that is much more like the Brazilian Roswell with,
he touched
two small children
seeing
an alien hovering in the street, or not hovering, but crouched in the street to firemen picking up or being involved in coming to the scene, and lots of policemen and military, lots of witnesses to a creature.
How did the police officer die? Do you know?
I don't remember right off the top of my head.
I had heard he had gotten too close to the wreckage. Much like those people who would bleed from the nose.
In the Roswell case.
Something happened to him.
Right. Well, you know, just a warning, although it's probably more likely to win the lottery than come in contact with a live ET, you certainly don't want to shake their hand.
No, you don't want to do any of that. Well, stay with us, Ryan. One more hour to go. We'll come right back. We'll take phone calls for the rest of the hour with our guest, Ryan Wood. His website is Magic Eyes Only. It's all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Ryan, tell me about the Cape Girardeau, Missouri case, 1941. What have you uncovered there?
Well, this goes back to Leonard Stringfield, who originally published the Charlotte Mann story, who's the granddaughter of Reverend Huffman. And Reverend Huffman was a Baptist minister living in Cape Girardeau in 1941, and he was asked to come to the scene of an airplane crash. But when he got there, it was not an airplane crash, but a crashed saucer, sort of more of an acorn-like shape, more like Kecksburg, that was broken open and had two ET bodies in one area and one set off to the other side, hieroglyphic markings inside the craft and a burned area. And he was asked to give blessings to the ETs, and he did that. And then the military came and swore everybody to secrecy and carted everything off. But there was quite a number of witnesses there. So we have documents that talk about a crash. Some of the Leak Majestic documents talk about a crash in Missouri in 1941. We have the testimony of Charlotte Mann, who's the granddaughter of Reverend Huffman, given to her on a deathbed confession of Reverend Huffman's wife, Flo Huffman. And that forms sort of the kernel of believability. And then you have some second-tier witnesses, the brother of the sheriff, Clarence Shady, remembers a story like this. And there's a couple other people that are alive today that remember, you know, rumors like this. You know, I would not give them high credibility, but they remember stories like this back in the 40 time frame. Or 41.
You know, I as I was mentioning, I'd go to Cape Girardeau for my son's college. I mean, is it specific enough to know where this thing crashed?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is sort of. We know that Reverend Huffman was driven 15 minutes, 20 minutes outside of town, and he had gone west. If you go east, you go across the Mississippi, and there's a limited number of roads. We know that he went in like a quarter of a mile off the road. So there's it's a bounded problem. I have looked at, I've used dowsers, I've used intuitives, I've looked at historical aerial photography. The whole place was overflown in 1941 in October with 9-inch stereo negatives that you can pour through. So if I had like a couple weeks and $4,000 or $5,000, I could get all the stereos blown up and get real serious and real accurate about finding this scar in the earth and the area, the exact location. And then once you have the exact location, it's game over. It's time to go in and look with the metal detectors and find evidence that I think is still there, because they, you know, in by Roswell time, I think they had gotten their act together.
Well, you know, because of the significance of the alleged crash, you would think the area would have been scoured by now, and it really hasn't.
No, no, and I think that's the case with a lot of crashes, that the it's one thing to, you're assigned this task of clean up the area, spend a couple days at it, and look around and make sure you get everything. But you know how these archaeologists work nowadays. They grid off everything and dig down the next meter, and they sift through every single thing to try to find a shard. And I think there's loads of shards left at a lot of these crash sites. And for the military to clandestinely try to go back and do a full-on next-level archaeological scouring is just not feasible and would simply draw a lot of attention.
To the phones we go. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hi, George. My name is Ryan. I'm from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
George, I'd like to thank you, first of all, for being brave enough to release a lot of this information that you do. It's really courageous of you. And, Ryan, the question that I pose to you is, you said there's been 74 extraterrestrial crash landings, which indicates to me that there would have been thousands, possibly millions of visitations over the course of the last thousands of years. Do you think, out of any of these visits, there's been a lot of civilizations with unexplained structures? Do you believe that at any time we've received any extraterrestrial technology?
Have we received extraterrestrial technology directly as a gift handed on the table? I think that's possible, but it's deep in the speculation of the field right now. I think that we've gotten a lot of technology just by recovering the wreckages and analyzing it and trying to reverse engineer it. You know, is the laser or is fiber optics or is night vision goggles or the integrated circuit linked back to extraterrestrial hardware? And I think the answer is, it very likely could be, but the research to prove it really hasn't been done.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay.
You know, Area 51, an area that, of course, continues to reach our mysteries of our minds. Do you believe they're still conducting some kind of UFO research there, or have they, as some people have speculated now, Ryan, transferred this to other regions of the country?
Well, I think that, you know, once you have a good facility for doing ET research, you're not going to give it up. It's a nice, secure location. The answer is, yeah, I think they're doing some level of work there. But I also believe that White Sands Proving Grounds is another location where there's all sorts of active military operations, reverse engineering ET hardware in deep underground bases and operating, you know, Mach 10 Earth to orbit or Earth to planet vehicles.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because tomorrow night Linda Moulton Howe is going to give us a report about White Sands.
Yeah, I've got a special project that I'm working on. One of the leaked photographs that came with the Majestic documents was a picture of White Sands with a big black X in the upper corner, and it said Area 29. It gave no explanation other than just this big block X and Area 29. And when I start going through the aerial photography that you can get on Terra Server or any of the other official servers, you find all sorts of interesting anomalous structures. I actually found, oddly enough, a line of like 20 semi-tractor trailers snaking down a road going directly into the side of a mountain.
20.
It was shocking. It was like, what? Didn't they understand that somebody's overhead satellites are going around? And it was just surprising, you know, all spaced out. And I've had done remote viewing projects on, you know, what's going on there and looked around, and there's lots of double fenced off structures that are 2 miles wide in a circle or sort of an octagon. There's some what looks like a target where you have a plus sign and then a series of circles surrounding it that go out like 2 miles. And you look at these structures and you say, what is this? Now, is it some sort of communications technology? There's lots of weird things going on White Sands, and it's one of our biggest base. I think it is the biggest base in the United States.
Yeah, I'm going to look forward to chatting with Linda about that. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, my name is Tim from West Michigan.
Hi there, Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a first time revealed family secret. When my mother passed away, we found some photographs and a letter from my uncle, who was, well, our family believed, shot down over Nagasaki back in the early 40s in a B-29 super fortress. And the pictures were of quite old and of some alien figures. The letter was an admission that my uncle never was shot down, that he was working for the government. He went on to explain that he was hired by the government to kill a colonel. I don't know if I should say his name or not.
Well, say, yeah, go ahead.
His name was Al Boss or Albert Boss, and that he was the colonel who flew the bodies from Roswell up to a facility in the Midwest, Clark or Clark Edwards, but something like that. Even named the ammo, the type of rifle he used, and everything. He said he shot him in Grayling, Michigan, while the guy was deer hunting.
Because
he was about to reveal the secret about these alien bodies. And sure enough, my oldest brother and I, my dad's just about ready to die. He'll kill me if I tell anybody any of this, but I'm telling you guys now because he's on his deathbed. We gave the photos, and anyway, we checked this out. And sure enough, there's an unsolved murder of this guy named Al Boss, who was a colonel in the United States Air Force up in Grayling, Michigan.
And how did he spell his last name?
I guess it was just B-O-S-S.
Al Boss. Okay, Grayling, Michigan.
Probably Albert Boss. And, well, that's fascinating.
What about these pictures?
Yeah, okay, so we confronted my father, who was ailing ill right now, and he demanded, it was his brother, apparently. So anyway, we gave him the photos and the letter. I asked him for an explanation, and he is yet to give them back. Now, the lady who cares for him right now is telling us that he burned all that evidence because he will not disgrace his brother's name.
And the brother's was the shooter?
His brother was the shooter, and his name is Clarence. I can give you more details off the air. I won't do it over the air.
No, I don't blame you. I'd love for you to stay in touch with us if I can put you on hold when we're done with this call with you. Maybe we can exchange numbers or something.
No problem.
That'd be great. Or send me an email from my website, you know.
Yeah, let me do that because, to be quite honest with you, gentlemen, I'm at work, and I got to get back to work here. But first, very quickly, my heart and prayer goes out to those miners and their families, and so I just want to get that in.
Okay, we're going to put you on hold, and you can get to Tom the information, and we will stay in touch with each other. You know, if he sounds legitimate to me, Ryan, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. These are wonderful stories, and I applaud him for having the courage to come forward. I think there are hundreds of these situations that people just need a little encouragement. They feel a little remorse or shame about what's occurred, and they need to clear their conscience before they die, and they end up telling the truth. And their evidence and documents and information is oh so valuable to uncovering the truth.
You've got to do a Google search for an Albert Boss Grayling and find out if there's a story there.
Well, I'm sure that it's probably not in
pretty
the electronic
old
form.
No, it's probably very old. You got to go in there and do it by hand.
Right, and I have a long list. I mean, I gave a talk at the second annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference on murders and Majestic 12, and I have a database of about 50 suspicious murders that I think are linked, and I would love to dig a little more and add this to the list.
Just keeps it going, doesn't it?
Yep. And there's 10 or so that are really obvious.
Let me tell you the authenticity of, because he's giving Tom all his information. Most people would have just hung up if they weren't real. He's staying on the line. And how many people would talk about their father who's ready to die in that kind of fashion? I mean, you don't joke about stuff like that.
Exactly. It takes a lot of courage to do that.
Let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. This is Avi from Tel Aviv.
Oh, Avi, welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Well, thank you very much. And hello, Ryan.
Hello.
Good morning. I would just like to ask you a question. It may sound a little cynical, but I don't mean it to. I'm just curious why, with all the even remote viewers and all the advantages you've had to investigate and probe, that you've not been able to come up with any literal, tangible evidence once again. And I'll be listening on the radio. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the question is the term literal, tangible evidence. And the answer is, if you consider parts of a crash saucer as literal, tangible evidence, which I do, the answer is we got it. In the case of the San Antonio 1945 case, Ramey Baca, a firsthand witness, has parts that he picked up personally when he was a young boy and has had it analyzed and is continuing his analysis. And he lives up in Washington. Linda Howe has got, you know, Art's parts from Roswell. Roger Lear, Dr. Roger Lear, famous for his abduction research, but also has a part of Roswell wreckage, allegedly, and it's been analyzed. Chuck Wade has dug up from the plains of St. Augustine parts, physical pieces of material that he believes came from the plains of St. Augustine crash in 47. And there are a couple more that have physical evidence. And really, the next book, if there's a next book for me in a couple of years.
How long did it take you to do this one?
Well, you know, probably about 9 months.
That's pretty fast.
It is pretty fast. But I had help. You know, I could call Jim Mars and say, you know, Jim, I want you to write the chapter on.
Yeah, he's good. I've been doing this. I've had help on mine, and it's still not done yet. It's at the publishers now, but that took about 2 years.
Yeah, so I was pretty dedicated and focused at it. And the next sort of area for me is all going to be on parts, all going to be on physical evidence. But the challenge with that is that I can get the physical evidence, you know, you can get the researcher and the part, and then you get it in front of a good lab, and you really need to pay the lab, you know, their full fees to be very effective and very rigorous and stand by their work and not be bullied in any way, shape, or form by any fallout.
I got to tell you, the caller who was mentioning the murder in Grayling, Michigan, which I'm familiar with being from Michigan, it sounded as believable as anybody I've talked to on the air, Ryan.
Yeah, I love it, and it's great, and I can keep, you know, working on other murders and people.
Well, I'll make sure that Tom gets you some information that he's given us, and let's make sure we follow up with each other on this guy.
Yeah, okay.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with you, Ryan Wood. And the rest of the calls, I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Ryan Wood, our guest. Ryan, what's new on your plate in the future? What are you up to?
I'm working on another crash retrieval. And it's that's the thing that's been consuming me of late. And I really don't want to, I should have it all buttoned up, but...
In this country,
it's historical. It offers the Holy Grail, and that is not only a good location with a good track record, but physical evidence and parts, which I believe are at the site. And it's not even in my book. That was one of the things that I discovered in, you know, looking at these crash retrieval events, is that I missed a few.
How do you know there are parts at the site?
Well, I mean, I have a variety of intelligence sources, but I don't want to discuss it all. But there's indications. I'm hopeful that there are parts at the site. We'll find out, and I'll go, and I'll spring this on the world and the public here probably at the next crash retrieval conference in November of 06. But it could be a really good one. Now, Linda Howe at the latest crash retrieval conference this last year talked about her new crash retrieval case.
That was the one in November, right?
Yeah, November. And yeah. She was talking about a case in Utah in 1953. And she's doing more research on that. It's a very interesting case where you have this gigantic triangular-shaped area that's like 2,000 feet on a side.
Yeah.
And apparently something that big.
And they buried it.
Crashed and buried it.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating case. And then here's an example of, you know, that case is neutral in the authenticity ratings, sort of. But, you know, if she works on it some more, she could easily find some physical evidence and bump it up and get more researchers involved and more physical evidence. And it could become, you know, very highly, even more credible case than many others.
You have dedicated this book to people who have lost their lives for the sake of UFO secrecy and investigations.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I feel that in this is, amongst other things, one of the crimes against humanity is this whole notion that we can't handle it, and we have to keep it secret, and we're going to kill people to prevent it.
That's a good point.
And that's really just kind of stupid.
We, about an hour ago, were talking about that Brazilian case in Virginia.
Yeah.
Not Virginia, but Virginia.
Virginia.
Tell me about that one more time, then we'll go to calls and wrap things up.
Yeah, there's several people saw some girls, actually.
Is this the same case that's in your book?
Yes, it is.
Gotta be. Okay.
Yeah, it is. Some small girls walking home saw an alien crouched against a garage repair shop, a car garage repair shop, and they described it as had bright red eyes, lidless eyes. It was very striking.
Propped up against the
propped
garage?
Up, crouched in sort of a nook, that's really, these two witnesses saw that and then called the police, and they chased it and eventually caught it and dragged it off, and witnesses heard it screaming in a bag, and the military took it away.
And then a police officer somehow died in the process.
Right. So he was one of the ones that I think handled the bag or put it in the bag.
Well, and here maybe again another biological virus problem.
Yeah, I think that absolutely is. That's the very dangerous aspect, and maybe not deliberate. You know, if they wanted to kill you, that'd be a different matter.
True.
But,
well, it sounds like there's a pattern here. If you see one, don't touch one.
Yeah, that's right.
No.
Definitely, that's very true.
Go to the phones again, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're with us. Hi.
Hello. My name is Roger. I live in Marble Hill, Missouri.
Now, where's that, Roger?
It's about 35 miles east of Cape Girardeau.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, Ryan. Hello, George.
Uh-huh.
And I believe it or not, this is not common knowledge about this crash around Cape Girardeau. I only found out myself about 4 years ago on the History Channel.
You're kidding me.
No.
All these years you've been out there?
Right. I've asked older people I know and things. It's really not common knowledge. But anyway, when I did hear about it, I heard about the Reverend Huffman, and I knew some Huffmans that live here. And one of them I used to see at the coffee shop all the time, was pretty good friends with, and I made the mistake of asking him about it in front of some other people.
Ah, what happened?
And he just didn't say anything.
He clammed up on you?
Yes. Well, about, I'd say a week later, I just happened to sit down at the table with him by himself, and he said, I do know all about that. He said, the Reverend Huffman was my great uncle.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, do you know where it crashed? And he said, I know exactly where it crashed. And I said, well, where was it? He said, well, I'll tell you sometime. And every month or so, I would ask him about that. And sadly, he passed away in his sleep one night.
And he never showed you the spot, did he?
He never told me where it was at. But he does have a couple of sons that doesn't live here. I see them every once in a while, and I'm going to ask them if he ever told them about it.
Would you have gone to see the site?
Oh, yes,
yeah,
I would. I have seen two UFOs myself. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was pretty commonplace to see UFOs in this area. I do have a question for both of you.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
In 1989, I was about 10 miles from Cape Girardeau on a back road, and we had a meteor shower. And my wife and I just stopped in the road a little ways from my house and watched the meteors. I mean, they was just coming by, and all of a sudden the sky lit up after the meteor shower, and there was a UFO. And it come within, oh, I'd say 200 feet of our car, about 50 to 100 feet in the air, and just hovered there. And my wife actually almost tried to climb out of the car. And I had heard or read somewhere where somebody got a radiation burn from doing that.
That's so possible.
I stopped her from doing that, and it moved a little ways right behind a house. And I backed up real quick and was pulling into the driveway of the house, and it just turned, did a 190, and took off, and within 30 seconds it was out of sight.
Did it have a lot of lights around it?
Yes. It was just like the drawings that you see on TV.
Sure, or like the movie Close Encounters of the Third
Correct.
Kind. Yeah.
Correct. But my question is, have you got reports of UFOs with meteor showers? And I'll listen and hang up.
Okay, sir. Now, that's a pretty interesting question, Ryan, because sometimes they are in the vicinity of some of these celestial events. So what are the odds of a UFO being close by?
Well, you know, the odds are probably pretty good. You know, I think every night somewhere on the planet there's a visible UFO. These meteor showers and showers occur, you know, periodically throughout the year, and you have to be lucky at the right time and right place to see it. Do they use it as cover? I think that they don't bother. They sort of
not anymore.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, in a lot of the movies you would see, when you'd see these tremendous cloud patterns developing, mm-hmm. with lights underneath or behind them, a major size UFO would come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's any need for it. I mean, they can either cloak or uncloak. They can, you know, hide in clouds like they did on the History Channel in the Mexico sightings that was reported last month on the History Channel, or not, where they zoom in and out of a helicopter formation in broad daylight. You know, different civilizations have different missions and different requirements and different agendas, and it's hard to tell. I'm fascinated. I would love to follow up with that guy and try to dig around and advance the Cape Girardeau case a little more.
It's got to be exciting and at the same time very scary to be within 50 feet or 100 feet of a craft like that. And you know it's not of this planet. If you know, it's just, it's got to be unbelievable. I've never seen one. I sure would like one. Hey, what about you, Ryan?
I've never seen a UFO. I've always been an analyst, interested in the phenomenon and taking an analyst viewpoint. And my father has never seen one either. He's been wanting to see one a long time. So we both come out of this mold of being intellectually curious about this phenomenon, this very important phenomenon.
All right, back to the more phone calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
Hi. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a question for your guest and a little story to tell you. George, I sent you an email a couple months ago about this. Perhaps you didn't get it. But speaking, okay, I'm Mike from Ohio, by the way.
Okay.
And speaking to the back engineering aspect of it, Ryan, have you ever heard of or spoken to anybody who's ever seen a conventional military aircraft powered by some other force other than a jet engine?
No, but I've heard rumors that there's some helicopters that have anti-gravity control in them.
Okay. The reason I asked, George, this happened about 25 years ago. A friend of mine and I, it was in the autumn part of the year. It was at night, about, it was after 11 o'clock at night, but the sky was backlit from lights from the city, nearby city. And we were standing talking, and I heard a sound, just a rustling of leaves in the tree, in the top of this tree. And I thought, that's strange, there's no wind tonight or anything. And I looked up, and hovering right above the tree, about 25 feet, the tree was probably 20-some feet,
mm-hmm.
It was hovering right above this tree. It was a Harrier, an AV-8 Harrier, and I know it was a Harrier. I recognized the silhouette.
What was it doing there?
It was just hovering. We didn't know it was there at all.
I mean, but why would it be there?
I don't know. This is really bizarre. It happened here in Ohio. This was like 25 years ago, and it was just hovering there. And the only way that we detected it was I noticed I heard this rustling of leaves, and it was the only the leaves in the tree, just in this one tree, were just moving like in a breeze, but there was no wind. And it was just the leaves in the top of the tree moving. And that's when I saw the Harrier. And he just hovered there for like maybe a minute or half a minute. And then he started to move off. And as he did, I had the presence to look at the cockpit through the canopy, and I could see a helmet. It looked like he was looking at us, and then he turned his head in the direction that he was moving. And I strained to hear anything at all. And all you could hear is a slight whistling sound, very, very faint, but you would never hear it unless you were listening for it, straining for it. And I think it was just the air moving across the fuselage and the wings. And when he got about maybe 50 yards away, he turned on his night position lights. I'm a pilot, so I know what they look like. They were standard position lights. Then he turned on his landing light. It was brilliant. It lit up the trees in front of him. It lit up part of the ground underneath him. And he moved slowly, probably 20 knots, moved away at 20 knots, never picked up speed, never gained altitude, and we just watched him until he was out of
right.
sight.
Well, you know, the first Harrier was made in 1971, so it very well was one of those.
Well, but, you know, being in the military, I was in air defense artillery, and at the time, they didn't have some of the more modern weapons like Stinger that could recognize friend from foe. So back then, we had to be able to identify by silhouette only all aircraft in NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And I was stationed in Europe. I've been very close to Harriers before.
Well, if you weren't in the military and had the knowledge of what they look like, if you were just a civilian, could you have confused that with a UFO, do you think? Do you think some people have?
I don't know. To me it was plain. The person that was with me didn't have a clue as to what it was, but I knew exactly the shape of a Harrier.
They're very sure.
Distinct, but yeah.
Would that person have thought it was extraterrestrial?
That's a possibility. It could have been mistaken for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been close to Harriers before. Not that close, because they use the Rolls-Royce Pegasus engine, which is like notoriously loud. And ear splitting.
Oh, that'll blow your ears out.
And we were 25 feet from this tree, and the tree was maybe max 25 feet high, and it was right over top of this.
Okay, well, thank you. Where'd you go? You still there? You still there?
Off of that tree,
yeah.
If it was a jet engine.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate you. It's not a UFO, but it's an interesting story. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, Tom from Seattle.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm presently calling from Chula Vista, California, listening to you on KOGO San Diego.
Absolutely. Our number one station in San Diego.
You got it. Okay, I tuned in just at the tail end, the last hour, and I during the break I thought, well, I'll try to give a call, and I am in. And comes to find out when you introduced Ryan that his expertise is perhaps a little bit different from what I wish to relate, but I think it's interesting enough to relate anyhow.
Can you do it in a minute?
I can do it, yes.
Go.
Okay, in 64 or 65, when I was in the Navy, I was on the aircraft carrier Ranger. We were on station off the coast of Vietnam. And I worked in the operations office, so I was pretty well aware of what was going on around the ship. And all at once, we got to real super secret activity. And come to find out, the destroyers around us identified an object that they could not identify underneath the carrier.
Underneath it.
Yes, underneath. And it just followed the ship wherever we went. We tried evasive movements and going fast and coming to a dead stop. And during those days, I guess they didn't have quite the capability of detecting things as today, or at least identifying them. And the operations officer and the captain, the XO, was really quiet about this. But via the intelligence people and communications people, I knew I got some information. But nobody can identify this, and I understood that our government worked through State Department with other governments to see if anyone had a submarine in the area, and everything came up negative. They didn't know what it was, and then about the third or fourth day, whatever it was, it just disappeared as quickly as it appeared.
Well, after listening to a show like this, Ryan, I think we know what it was. Ryan, we're out of time. Thanks. Great work with the book. And let's make sure everyone has a chance to go to Amazon.com or your website, which is linked on coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks so much, George.
Appreciate you being on the show. For Nikki Imbrononi, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.